Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week, two stories. More mayors under arrest. Turkey's anti-opposition clampdown just took a serious turn for the worse. And solidarity in adversity. Press freedom takes centre stage at the DW Global Media Forum.
This honour is not only mine. It belongs to a team of professional journalists, fact-checkers, disinformation researchers, who are on the front line of hybrid warfare, and by defending media ecosystem, they are protecting information integrity and democracy.
We were actually planning to go all out on a media special this week, but decided to change our plans so that we could highlight the following story, which we think is potentially very significant. Three more opposition mayors have been arrested in Turkey, ostensibly as part of a graft probe. Rights groups, however, are very clear that these arrests are politically motivated and represent a grave development in President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's ongoing crackdown on opposition. Our Istanbul correspondent, Dorian Jones, has this report.
Thousands marched through the streets of the Mediterranean city of Adana in protest at the arrest of its mayor on alleged corruption charges. The mayors of Antalya and Adıyaman were also detained on similar charges. All the mayors belong to Turkey's main opposition, CHP party. The legal crackdown started in March with the jailing of Istanbul's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu. But the anti-corruption probes are continuing to accelerate. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, addressing parliament, vowed there would be no letting up on the crackdown.
We launched an investigation into the largest theft ring in the history of the Republic, the most reckless organized crime organization ever. Those who took bribes, those who practically held cities under extortion, those who put people in a difficult situation and then robbed them were all CHP people.
This month saw the ruling AKP party start the process to lift the parliamentary immunity of 61 CHP deputies, which requires a simple majority of votes in parliament. The party leader, Özgür Özel, is also under investigation for allegedly inciting public hatred and insulting the president. Özel is at the forefront of organising anti-government protests across the country, which continue to attract large crowds as the party builds a significant lead over Erdogan's AKP party. CHP spokesman İlhan Özgel says the corruption probes are motivated by his party's growing popularity.
We are trying to cope with this multi-layered attacks on our party. Waves of arrests every other day. Around 14 of our mayors, including the Istanbul mayor, are in prison right now. These are politically driven arrests and investigations that involves only opposition parties, but not a single government party. Mayors are even investigated. Because the CHP, as the main opposition party, is on the rise, it's getting more popular. So the government is doing everything at its hand to stop its rise.
The editor of the opposition, Sözcü TV station, condemning its 10-day closure by regulatory authorities. Sözcü is banned for inciting public hatred for his broadcasting of the protests against the jailing of the Istanbul mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu. Another opposition TV station, Halk, is also facing a similar ban. Erol Önderoğlu of the Paris-based Reporters Without Borders warned Sözcü's ban could mark the beginning of the end of critical media.
The threat is not just against Sözcü TV. It is much more reflecting a liquidation attempt of critical media in an unprecedented regime crisis in Turkey. So I'm not optimistic on the fact that this will be just the final step. The second half of 2025 will be very important, not only about the crackdown on well-known, prominent, resonating journalists targeted one by one, arrested, jailed, but also whether or not critical national TV station will have a place next year in Turkey.
Opposition TV stations like Sözcü are among the few media outlets that continue to report on the ongoing CHP protests against the waves of arrests. Opinion polls indicate over 60% of people believe that detentions are politically motivated. While anger continues to grow against the government, over 40% inflation. Political analyst Sezin Öner of the Politikyol News Portal warns a political showdown is looming over the future of democracy.
Turkish democracy is in the deathbed, actually. What really matters is where the security forces stand. When it comes to the point that people take it to the streets en masse, will the security bureaucracy go against their own people?
Neither the opposition CHP nor Erdogan showing any signs of backing down. Protests are expected to continue and likely intensify in September, coinciding with the reopening of universities and the return of people from summer vacations, as well as further legal actions against the CHP. With both sides insisting they are fighting for the future of their country, it's likely to be a fight that leaves only one side standing. Doreen Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Turkey's crackdown on opposition is, of course, also a media crackdown. Sadly, Turkey's trajectory is by no means an anomaly at the moment. According to Reporters Without Borders' tracking tool, 584 journalists and media workers are currently imprisoned around the world. Since the 1st of January this year, 19 journalists have been killed, almost a quarter of them in Gaza. This, then, was the sobering backdrop to the 2025 edition of DW's Global Media Forum, a two-day conference gathering journalists and media workers from around the world for panels on everything from digital authoritarianism and AI to forgotten crises and conflict reporting. Our eyes and ears at the event belonged to none other than the newest member of the Inside Europe team, Austrian-born political journalist and producer Laura Kabelka. Laura is here with me in the studio now, and it is my great pleasure to be able to introduce her to you. Laura, welcome. This is where you say hello, Laura.
Hi, it's Laura.
Are you Laura? Are we going with Laura?
Both are fine. Laura, Laura, whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
But as a good Austrian, really, it should be Laura, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because I was making an effort here.
Yeah, thank you. It's sweet.
Okay. You can really show me up otherwise. But anyway, it's wonderful to have this chance to be able to introduce you to everybody because you are the new permanent member of Inside Europe.
Yes.
So, yeah, this is a voice that we'll be hearing a lot of in weeks to come. And you were straight in at the deep end because in the second week of joining the team, we sent you off to cover Deutsche Welle's Global Media Forum.
Indeed.
For us. The clue is in the title. It's about the media and the aspirations are global. Did it live up to that?
Yes, in that respect, for sure, because there are really people from all over the world coming to this forum. This year, there were around 900 people, like over 160 speakers, and I think they came from over 100 different countries. So you can really mingle with people from all over the world.
I've met so many incredible people, and also I got to see many panels. Today, I was at a panel about Latin American media that impressed me a lot.
I think the GMF Global Media Forum is just different from other conferences. You know, it doesn't have very many Americans. It's not dominated by British people. You know, it's a genuine global conversation and community.
If you're able to speak to someone who has lived his life in Afghanistan, has moved to Germany and helping immigrants, if you can speak to someone who is of Bangladeshi background but based elsewhere across the world, or someone who is from Sudan but has to move to Egypt to work from Egypt based on their unique stories and issues, then definitely barriers are being broken.
The title under which this was all happening, because each year there's a new title, a new banner, this year it was Breaking Barriers, Building Bridges. What do you think was meant by that? Like, which barriers were being broken, which bridges were being built, and how successful was it?
Yeah, it's a question I asked myself and other participants as well, because on the one hand, if you think that building bridges means connecting people with others from other places of the world that you might not usually go to or meet or from different fields, then definitely bridges can be built at such an event. But I also heard from a participant that, in fact, those that we need to talk to more and work with or deal with better weren't really present. So the big tech that everyone talked about were a small minority there. So there was somebody from Microsoft, for example. But I also attended a panel on disinformation and the connection to health, where Google or Meta were only being talked about and not talked with. I've also seen this at other conferences. I went to the Republika, for example, this year, and the participants there also seem pretty aligned with their values and beliefs. So there's always this danger of what we call navel gazing in German, right? That we talk about super divisive issues with people that have similar views on them.
Okay, so a sort of a safe space. There were lots of journalists in exile I saw on the guest list.
Yes,
so
exactly.
Perhaps building bridges amongst a kind of an us that we're quite comfortable with. And
yeah, it's more like building alliances, I would say, with people who might be like-minded. And it's, of course, also important to save them and give them a safe space. So it's a tightrope walk, right? You cannot really do everything at such an event.
So building alliances amongst people working in the media space against a global context in which that is becoming increasingly difficult and increasingly dangerous. And because I know who you had coming in and out of the studio on Monday, you had some really exciting interview partners.
Yes.
And we'll be hearing more from them in coming shows. You really, I think, must have got a sense of just how difficult the situation is in some countries.
Definitely. A lot of people have spoken to me, but also during the conference, about their particular country context, about the hostile environments because of state actors or maybe Russian influence, propaganda, or from other countries, of course, trolls. There was a panel on female intimidation, so against women journalists in particular, which is way higher than against men on average. But one of the people that we spoke to here is a Georgian journalist, Tamar Kintsurashvili, who was also awarded the DW Freedom of Speech Award for her work on disinformation and media literacy. So she's a very brave and inspiring person. There's been an intense crackdown on independent media, as well as her personally, and in general against the opposition and protesters in Georgia. So that's what she also talked about in her acceptance speech.
This honor is not only mine. It belongs to a team of professional journalists, fact-checkers, disinformation researchers, who are on the front line of hybrid warfare, and by defending media ecosystem, they are protecting information integrity and democracy, not only in Georgia, but across the region. This honor also belongs to all freedom fighters in Georgia who believe in free society and liberal democracy and have been protesting in the streets for more than 7 months, since the government announced its decision to postpone EU association talks until 2028. In December 2023, Georgia proudly celebrated EU candidate status, hoping to consolidate its democracy, strengthen institutions, and benefit from the integration into the European family, built on shared values. However, since then, the Georgian government has introduced at least 70 repressive legislative pieces targeting the civil society actors, media, and these legislative pieces are inconsistent with European values.
So this was Tamar, and we will actually be hearing more from her in an upcoming episode soon.
I'm really looking forward to that. I'm also, Laura, looking forward to hearing all about your encounters with an EU commissioner. And that is coming up right after the break. So, Laura, one of the most high-profile people on the DW Global Media Forum guest list was none other than the EU Commissioner for Enlargement, Marta Kors. And it was you who did the official DW interview.
Yes. There were loads of people wanting to talk to her, but we had arranged an interview with her on the sidelines of the GMF.
So I can imagine that there were lots of people wanting to speak to Marta Kors, because if you are a journalist from a country with candidate status, this is the person who has answers about the state of your country's application, right?
You know, right now, there are 9 candidate countries. We have the 5 Western Balkans, so Albania, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Montenegro, North Macedonia and Serbia. Then we have Georgia, Moldova and Ukraine, of course. And then there's also Turkey, but negotiations have been pretty much frozen since 2016. Also for some other countries, as in the case of Georgia, as Tamar mentioned, or Serbia, we cannot really expect much development in the next years, if any at all. That's because these negotiations bring loads of tasks for the candidate countries, loads of reforms that they have to do before they can move on. Reforms on the justice system, fundamental rights, media freedom, the economy, etc. But for other countries like Albania, Montenegro, or Ukraine and Moldova, there is hope for EU accession on the horizon. So here's what Commissioner Kors said about this prospect.
I will do everything I can that Ukraine will become a member of the EU, as our President von der Leyen says, perhaps even before 2030. It's amazing what the Ukrainians are doing today. You know, while the bombs are falling on their country, they negotiate for the EU accession. They do necessary reforms, and there is a lot of reforms to do. So they are so good, you know. Imagine in the normal circumstances, it is not easy to negotiate. But now they do during the war times.
I mean, Laura, the Ukrainian example is obviously incredibly dramatic because of the circumstances, right? To, you know, be wanting to be aspiring to enter the EU whilst your country is actively at war, it doesn't happen very often. And I guess, you know, in a case like that, you often hear from countries that have been waiting, have had candidate status for a very long time, that there is sort of concern that, you know, maybe we might be entering an era where geopolitics might perhaps be trumping merit.
Previously, the Commission has always said there are no shortcuts. So merit-based approach it is. And this is something that Marta Kors kind of repeated, because she said we cannot afford to have countries which are not ready for the economic market or that's what she said, right? Countries who are not able to defend democracy or the rule of law within the union, because that, of course, will not make our union stronger, and enlargement is supposed to make our union stronger. So she emphasized again that you really have to fight for it, which is definitely what Ukraine is doing. And the commissioner herself is from Slovenia. So that's a country that joined the European Union in 2004. So it was one of the 10 countries that was part of this largest wave of enlargement to date. And she said when her country joined, it was one of the happiest days of her life. And so I asked her about the difference between enlargement then and the situation now.
It is not only about the economy. Probably when Slovenia became a member, we have seen our membership mostly through the prosperity glasses. But EU membership today, it's about peace. Can you imagine that in 2025 we speak again that EU is there to provide peace in Europe?
Lara, another question that you asked, I think, was about Serbia. I'd really like to ask you about this one, because Serbia is a country that we've been featuring a lot on the programme recently because of the protests in Belgrade calling for snap elections. Those protests, right? I've been looking at all the footage, and there is one thing that I've noticed, and that is that in contrast to protests that you've seen in Tbilisi, like the capital of Georgia, for example, I haven't been seeing European flags being waved.
Exactly. Yeah. That is something that others have also noticed. And I did ask the commissioner about this. And she actually said that to some extent, the demands that protesters in Serbia have are similar to the demands that the EU has to Serbia in order to accede, in order to join the EU. So that's anti-corruption, the rule of law and media freedom. So these are demands. But she also gave some reasons why Serbian citizens don't really seem to care too much about the EU at this point.
I'm in constant touch with the civil society organization, with professors, with universities. And I was asking many, many people this question. And it is very interesting what did they tell me. The first is you are supporting our president Vucic. Secondly, you bombed us. Okay, it was NATO, but you bombed our country. A third, you want us to recognize Kosovo. And fourth, we don't want to make Russia angry.
And of course, with Serbia, Lara, you've got the added complication that you have a political system which is increasingly identified with one man, President Vucic. Segue here to Hungary, where Viktor Orban, of course, has been synonymous with Hungary for so long. Hungary is in the club. It's an EU member. This means that it has veto rights, which Viktor Orban is known to use strategically as leverage.
Exactly. And this could be another blocker or barrier in the path to accession to other countries. So I asked the commissioner about this as well. And she said that they are talking to Hungary and hoping to find a solution. But it just also shows that there are other issues on the way, and there is fragmentation within the union already. So this could also then mean that maybe there should be institutional reforms. And a lot of experts are saying that maybe institutional reforms, so how voting works, for example, should go hand in hand with a larger EU.
It's this sort of fascinating cocktail, isn't it, of politics and aspiration. Lara, thank you so much for unpicking all of that for us. We will be coming back to some of the fascinating interviews that you've been gathering at DW's Global Media Forum in future shows. For the meantime, you are listening to Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock, and also Lara Kaberka in Bonn. Thank you. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn.
Big powers basically don't care much about any rules or order, but just care about their interests. And that is a world that is way more dangerous. At the same time, though, there are people who, and there are whole countries and nations who are actually not giving up.
From Russia's war in Ukraine, to the anti-government protests in Georgia, to attacks on the media and NGOs further afield. At heart, these conflicts represent a schism between two opposing visions of the world, authoritarianism versus liberal democracy. It might feel like the latter is very much on the back foot at the moment, but in the post-Soviet space, activists and journalists are getting organised. Rob Cameron reports from Prague.
A Ukrainian news report on the Palm Sunday attack on the northeastern town of Sumy, situated just 25 kilometres from the Russian border. It was a double tap attack, first an Iskander missile targeting the city centre, then a second strike as rescue workers rushed to the scene. At least 35 people were killed, 129 injured, including 15 children. This report on the deadliest Russian attack on Ukrainian civilians since 2023 was by the regional media organization Kordon Media, one of numerous media outlets that have sprung up in Ukraine since Russia's full-scale invasion. Daria Rachenka is a war correspondent and Kordon's chief financial officer.
Kordon, it means border in Ukrainian, Kordon. Why? Because Sumy region actually has the longest border with Russia. It's more than 500 kilometers. In the beginning of the war, four of us, we just decided, okay, let's do something. How should we call us? Okay, it was like first stupid idea, like Kordon Media, why? It's so simple. But now it's very reasonable, understandable for our audience. And actually, it's not four of us now. In 2 years, we became a team, like 20 people.
Understandably, says Daria, most of their material is coverage of the war. Kordon has seven accredited war reporters at the front, which is the scene of constant bombardment and skirmishes between Ukrainian and Russian forces along a border zone which is now a no man's land. But while Kordon is a young team of media professionals, the stresses and strains of war are already keenly felt. Sumy Oblast is cursed with Ukraine's longest border with Russia, and some analysts believe the region could be the target of the next major push by Vladimir Putin. Daria is already making contingency plans.
I want to believe everything is going to be okay, everything is going to be fine. I have this faith inside. But I have to calculate different opportunities. So far, half of our team is already relocated to the west part. Pregnant lady, their families, kids, dogs, cats, I don't know. Even our operational director, she's so afraid, she can't focus on everything. She has to be in calm conditions to make her job. All of us, we are different. For example, all our war correspondents, they are like crazy people. It's definitely crazy people because when it's something, bam, bam, normal people walking away, we, okay, give us camera, we'll go there, we have to be there, we have to be first there. So it depends. And so for now, we have three steps of relocation. First, it's already done, like operational team. The second one, in case partly occupation situation, third one, full occupation. So when we have to move everything, equipment, office, even our war correspondent.
I was speaking to Daria inside a former Benedictine nunnery perched on a hill overlooking Prague, now privately owned, and this year hosting events like this, the annual Unlock Civic Summit. UNLOC is run by the Prague Civil Society Centre, a non-profit supporting civil society, activism and independent media in the post-Soviet space. The 19th century corridors during lunch were a babel of languages, from Belarusian to Kyrgyz, Georgian to Czech. Rostislav Valvoda is the organization's director.
We, as many others, have lost funding and have had to adapt and cut programs and cut staff, unfortunately. But, you know, I think there is a deeper problem in a sense there, and that is that it really is a sort of rearranging of geopolitics. We have entered a world that is much to Vladimir Putin's and Xi's design and wish. That is a world where the big powers compete for influence and where the big powers basically don't care much about any rules or order, but just care about their interests. And that is a world that is way more dangerous. That is a world with more tension and conflict and war, unfortunately. At the same time, though, as I mentioned before, there are people who, and there are whole countries and nations who are actually not giving up. And I think one of the lessons of this year's UNLOC is how many actually amazing people are not giving up and continue to fight. And in some way, you know, every impulse creates sort of some reaction.
One country locked in an existential struggle between these two competing visions, Russia-style authoritarianism versus European liberal democracy, is Georgia. The country's hopes of joining the EU and NATO are now on life support, thanks to the increasingly repressive policies of the pro-Moscow government, which has led to huge regular demonstrations. The authoritarian government is led by the Georgian Dream Party, a vehicle for the billionaire oligarch Bidzina Ivanishvili. One woman who knows him well is former Defence Minister Tina Kidasheli, whose party sat in coalition with Georgian Dream until 2016. Her Civic Idea think tank now opposes them and has joined the fight for Georgia's European future.
I'm not pessimistic about the future of Georgia. Only thing that worries me is that there is a certain level of leadership crisis in a country, and somehow the people's optimism, people's fight, people's struggle is disattached from the political process that is to be run by the political parties. But I think it's a very temporary short period of time, and we will get there. Road is hard, long, we understand it. We are facing for the first time a regime that does not care about the political consequences. It never happened before. Who does not care about its own legacy, which is very different from everything we know about the politics. But regardless of that, people are really determined to win this fight.
The questions asked at this meeting of post-Soviet activists, journalists and NGO workers were a window into the struggle they face in their repressive home countries. How do I remain ethical when the other side isn't? What can I learn from failure? Who can I trust to work with? These are difficult questions in an increasingly hostile world. For DW, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
They say that a picture is worth a thousand words. Personally, as a radio journalist, I tend to be quite sceptical of that claim. But there again, there is Gianluca Costantini. He's an Italian cartoonist whose work you've almost certainly seen somewhere, even if you didn't know whose it was at the time. His drawings have supported dozens of human rights campaigns, including those of Amnesty International, and his visual documentation of protests, revolutions and abuses worldwide has earned him thousands of international followers. This year, the city of Bologna in Italy hosted a series of events dedicated to Costantini's art activism, including a retrospective exhibition in the Old Town Hall entitled Ceasefire, 2005 to 2025, 20 years of struggles for human rights. Danny Mitzman's been tracing his journey from pens to protests for us.
Questo è uno studio molto piccolo, in verità.
I've come to visit Gianluca Costantini in his studio in central Ravenna. It's about an hour east of Bologna, where he's a professor of comic art at the Academy of Fine Arts.
Io lavoro molto a computer digitale adesso.
It strikes me as really tidy and well organized for an artist's studio. On his desk, there's a copy of Zodiac, the graphic memoir he made with his partner Eletra Stambulis about the life of Ai Weiwei. After connecting on Twitter, the Chinese dissident artist wanted Gianluca to draw his story. A filing cabinet in one corner contains a pre-digital archive divided by nation.
Archiviavo tutti I disegni che facevo per un luogo.
I can see Bangladesh.
Questo è Bangladesh, la Biafra, Birmania, Cambogia, Cina.
Two decades worth of cartoons drawn for human rights campaigns, but that was never his original plan. Gianluca says he actually chose comic art because all he needed was paper and a black pen. Coming from a poor family, it was simply the cheapest medium.
It's something that happens slowly over time. It's not like one day I said to myself, I want to do this. I'd already been drawing and publishing illustrations for over 10 years, images that had nothing to do with reality. Then in 2001, I went on a trip to Sarajevo as an invited artist at an art biennale held just after the war. That instantly changed my perspective.
April 1992. Thousands of Bosnians took to the streets against a looming war. Then gunfire. The spiral of violence that had started the year before in neighboring Croatia reached the ethnically and religiously mixed Bosnian Republic.
I came from Ravenna, this gentle provincial town where nothing really bad happens. And I found myself in a war zone. They gave you a special map because there were mines in the streets. People lived in houses without walls. Everything was pierced by bullets. Other artists I met at the time, especially foreign ones, like Joe Sacco or Alexander Zograf, was a Serbian cartoonist, showed me that I could also use comics to tell the story of reality, something that 20 years ago was not as obvious as it is now.
Back then, social media didn't exist, and Gianluca started posting on an international, no global website. His images, accompanied by a few simple words, which were translated into dozens of languages, soon gained a worldwide fan base.
Even back then, many people involved in the events of those drawings wrote me emails, like the mother of an American soldier, a former American football player who had died in Afghanistan. She asked to use one of my drawings as a tribute to her son on his memorial webpage. That's when I began to understand what I could do.
With the global explosion of Twitter, Gianluca started documenting events like the Arab Spring and the Israel-Gaza conflict with images combined with just a few words in English.
I started following what was going on in those places with my drawings. Back then, Twitter was used as a means of communication for mobilizing people. They took my drawings and used them during their protests. That was when things completely changed for me, because the work I did here in my studio went off and took on a life of its own, even thousands and thousands of miles away. For me, that was then the key that made me want to continue.
Quello dopo è stato proprio per me la chiave per continuare.
Unrest is spreading across the Arab world. Iran's leaders railed against the United States 2 days after two people were killed during opposition protests.
As well as using social networks, Gianluca set up his own website, Channel Draw, as an online archive and information portal.
Dopo un po' questo, ogni cosa che pubblicavo aveva una viralità.
After a while, Everything I published went viral and people started asking me to draw things, whereas before it was me who decided. Today, it's often activists or families who ask me to draw a person or work with them, because they know that if I then publish that drawing, it can be really helpful. It will start appearing all over the place, on websites, on the profiles of other important activists and journalists. You end up becoming a sort of useful human rights influencer.
Yet it wasn't until far more recently, through a campaign in Bologna, that Gianluca Costantini decided he was more than simply an artist.
After many years doing drawings for human rights, little by little other people started telling me I was an activist. I didn't really know what that meant. But when I started doing things with them, like going to demonstrations, I saw that they considered me an activist. So I think it's a good definition because I don't only draw, I physically go to places with people and do things in person with them.
Do you remember that time, the first time that somebody defined you as an activist?
I think the first time was when there was a big case in Italy, the case of Patrick Zaki.
Patrick Zaki was an Egyptian student at Bologna University who'd been arrested on a trip home to visit his family. Gianluca was quickly alerted on Twitter by an Egyptian source he trusted. As there were no good photos of the student available, he asked Gianluca to draw him.
Quello è stato fatto il 7 febbraio.
I did it on the 7th of February 2020, exactly 30 minutes after Patrick disappeared at Cairo Airport. I did it in a quarter of an hour and we published it right away. News started to circulate quickly, and within 12 hours, Amnesty had launched a campaign for his release.
Amnesty ha fatto una campagna dopo neanche 12 ore.
Anyone who lives in Bologna can instantly recognize Gianluca's drawing of Patrick Zaki because it appeared literally all over town. But a couple of weeks later, COVID-19 struck, and just as posters went up, Italy closed down. And that's when Gianluca's creativity as an artist activist really came into play, starting with getting the mayor of Bologna to put his image of Patrick on a 30-metre billboard in the main square.
We came up with the most absurd ideas, and we achieved almost all of them. Next, we did an installation inside the main university lecture theatre, which was closed. Instead of seated students, there were only cardboard cut-out Patrick Zakis. Then they were scattered around town. And when people were allowed out, they'd carry them around, take them as passengers in the car, take them out into the street. So for over 2 years, this drawing acted as a sort of adhesive, a symbol connecting every action, embraced by everyone.
C'era un seguito incredibile.
Italy welcomed the decision of an Egyptian court to release Patrick Zaki, a Coptic Egyptian doctoral researcher at the University of Bologna, after almost 2 years of preventative detention.
Patrick Zaki was released in December 2021. The campaign's success earned Gianluca an invitation to exhibit more of his work at Bologna's Old Town Hall.
Vederla, poi ovviamente farci introdurre a...
Fast forward to this year. Ceasefire 2005 to 2025. 20 years of struggles for human rights featured images from a variety of campaigns and causes he's drawn for and about. Gianluca's now banned from a list of countries, including one he's always loved, Turkey, where he was tried in absentia for terrorism after covering protests there. But it's a sacrifice he doesn't regret because of the enormous impact he knows his work can have to defend other people's freedom.
Il superpotere dei fumetti è che quando racconti anche un...
The superpower of comics is that when you describe even the most complex and difficult subject, thanks to the combination of words and drawings, you can really immerse people in it. I did a book on Libya with an Italian journalist, and when people read it, they said, "Now I understand what they were saying in the news." These drawings look extremely simple, but they are part of 20 years of work to make them as communicative as possible on any platform.
Danny Mitzman for DW in Ravenna.
And if you're now itching to see some of Gianluca's drawings, you will find a link in our show notes. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Finally this week, digitalisation. It's fundamental to smooth-running modern societies. Everyone in Europe seems to agree about that. Only some countries are doing it better than others. Estonia, for example, is a digital pioneer. 100% of its government services are available online. Germany, by contrast, is still something of a bureaucratic behemoth, and the government's very much aware of the problem. So, what could Germany, and indeed the rest of the continent, learn from Baltic's best practice? This sounds like a case for our satisfyingly alliterative Baltophile, Ben Batka.
Estonia has finally become a 100% digital nation. This means that we have gotten rid of all the bureaucracy. Estonia, 100% digital and 0% bureaucracy.
And when Estonia says 100% digital, it means 100% digital. The last part of civic life to go online? Divorce. As of last December, you can end your marriage online too.
This is a screenshot of my marriage relationship, and I had to do this with my wife present.
That's Lukas Ilves, former chief information officer of the Estonian government.
The scary thing is you click that button and you start pressing next, next, next. It takes 45 seconds to get to the point where it's like, submit the application. The other person also has to submit the application. So you can't quite divorce in 45 seconds.
Ilves is the author of a new study published with support of Germany's Friedrich Naumann Foundation. The study aims to see where Germany, a country where only 62% of the population uses digital government services, can learn from Estonia, where the uptake is over 90%. The answer is a lot. Take electronic identity verification, for example. 90% of Estonians use national EIDs to access government services, compared to less than 10% of Germans. Why? To Ilves, the answer is simple. The Estonian version is reliable, user-friendly, and can be used for both public and private sector services like banking.
Belgium has an EID that is technologically very similar to Germany's. For a very long time, had 10 or 20% of people using it. A few years ago, the banks and the telcos got together. They produced a very user-friendly mobile version of that EID that could be used both to log on to banks and to private sector services and for government services. And they got in 2 years to 80% uptake of the EID.
And the incentives for investing in a system that works are big. According to Ilves' study, Estonia currently spends 1/6 of what Germany spends on collecting tax revenue. And it's not just about efficiency savings either. Transparency and accountability are important too. According to the 2024 e-government monitor by nonprofit network D21, 80% of citizens who see their lives simplified by the state have great or very great trust in the state. That's compared to a population average of only 38%.
My name is Magdalena Zadara. I am Chief of Staff and Strategy at the German Digital Service.
Zadara and her 200 colleagues at the German Digital Service, founded in 2020 under then-Chancellor Angela Merkel, develop and implement software to digitalize administrative processes like online court procedures.
Currently, German government thinks about services in responsibilities. So they break every service down into different Zuständigkeiten, they call it in German. And that leads to very fragmented user journeys where things don't even use the same language oftentimes because different government offices are developing different parts of this journey. If I wanted to come to Germany to work from a country outside the EU, I would have to interact with probably about 5 to 7 different government agencies to get my diploma approved, to get a visa, etc. And they would maybe even ask for the same data of me.
This last bit is one of the most time-consuming and annoying aspects of having to deal with bureaucracy in Germany, as the author of this report can tell you a thing or two about. In Estonia, the so-called once-only principle, the idea that the government should reuse the data it already possesses instead of requiring individuals and businesses to resubmit information, is one of the pillars of the digital government. It's even codified in law.
What was the first time you used the digital signature? When was that?
When I became a new resident in 2015, and it was actually super easy. In Russia, even though it existed at the time, I was never able to go through the verification process because it was so complicated, completely unusable. Basically, in Estonia, it was like, yeah, okay, just get the card, you plug it in, and it works. It's magic.
That's Estonian-Russian entrepreneur Kirill Solovyov talking to me at an exhibition in Tallinn titled Why Estonia? From the USSR to E-Estonia. After Estonia, together with Latvia and Lithuania, regained its independence from the Soviet Union in 1991, Estonia brought the internet and computers to every classroom and library across the country in what became known as the Tiger Leap. The country of 1.3 million people took another big step in 2000 when online tax declarations became available and electronic signatures were recognized as legally equivalent to paper ones. By 2015, all major public services, including health and social services, had been fully digitized.
How do the digital prescriptions work in a nutshell?
You basically go to the doctor, and if they prescribe medicine, it's put into the online registry. And then you go to any pharmacy anywhere in Estonia and also in Finland, by the way. And then you just pull out your ID card, you give it to the pharmacist, and they see exactly what has been prescribed, the different like options you have. It's instant verification. You cannot go wrong because it's all digital. There's no deciphering illegible handwriting that's so common with doctors in some parts of the world. So like, it's easy, it's safe, and it's fast.
And no way of tampering with it, really. I mean,
no tampering.
But there is concern about tampering at an EU level. Europe's tech industry has been calling on EU lawmakers to reduce reliance on foreign-owned big tech like Google or Amazon by developing a so-called Eurostack, which would encompass everything from critical resources like energy, computer chips and other hardware, to cloud, communication and data infrastructure, as well as AI. But Lukas Ilves, the author of the report about digitalization in Estonia and Germany, warns of the high opportunity costs of what he calls reinventing the wheel and labeling everything from the US a risk.
We need to be much more concrete in focusing on very specific risks. Estonia, of course, is a small country, never decided to build an end-to-end Estonia stack. We built very specific applications and protocols on top of the global technology stack. And the question for Europe is, do we actually think we can succeed end-to-end building everything? I don't think so. No country can be autarkic and fully sovereign in the digital world. So we have to be smart with the Euro stack.
If European administrative behemoths like Germany are to keep up in the digital age, they could have a lot to learn from small and nimble countries like Estonia, even if it means divorcing online in only 45 seconds. Ben Wartke for DW.
A quick plug for our podcast. It's on all the usual platforms, and we really do appreciate your likes, ratings and reviews, as, of course, do these guys.
On Living Planet, we've got questions.
Is anyone trying to clean up this mess?
Big questions.
Should we really be sinking our money into this?
Questions that get to the bottom of things.
How much CO2 does a tree absorb anyway?
Your questions.
How often do you think we should use the reusable cups to compensate for the paper ones?
But don't worry, we've got answers too. Answers to help you navigate some of the biggest environmental issues of our time.
That's on Living Planet.
Find us wherever you get podcasts.
That's it for this week. Our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. This programme was produced by Laura Kabelka and me, Kate Laycock. Our sound engineer was Tsiad Abu Sleiman, with additional thanks to Gerd Georgi and Jürgen Kuhn. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.